From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we learn about the work Milwaukee company Cream City Conservation and Consulting is doing to create equitable workplaces. Then we learn how this year's Doors Open Milwaukee had to adjust its programming due to the pandemic.
Doors Open is by far our largest event that takes place every year, and so it's been a really great challenge and interesting to wrap our heads around new ways for people to interact with Milwaukee buildings without going to them physically.
Plus, Lake Effect contributor Melinda Myers shares her fall gardening tips.
One of the things we often forget about in fall, we get here and we're finally thinking, okay, the intense part of the growing season is over, but our plants are busy putting down roots, and so we need to make sure that we're watering properly.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Communities and workplaces around the country are grappling with the legacy of deep-seated racism. Many institutions are challenging themselves to diversify and create equitable environments. Cream City Conservation and Consulting is helping make that happen. The Milwaukee company takes a two-pronged approach, consulting and training. They work with environmental and community service organizations to address workplace culture and practices. They also train and employ young people from underrepresented communities. Cream City Conservation was founded by Milwaukee native August Ball. She met, socially distanced, with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz to talk about her work and the challenges that lie ahead.
What I've come to learn is that we can't begin the conversation around unconscious bias, because we don't actually have a collective understanding of how that unconscious bias is leaning towards white supremacy culture, right? So we have to understand why our biases lean the way they do, typically. And we see that regardless of ethnicity and race, the general populace does tend to lean having a more favoring bias towards whiteness and a more negative bias towards blackness. This is across the board, which is surprising, right? Because you would think people of color, right, especially people who are black, who identify as black, would not lean that way, but they do. And this is because of the continual messaging and normalization there is around anti-blackness. What I will also, beyond just establishing some shared language, I think it's also important for people to come to the table with the understanding that while on one hand we, you know, being a good person, quote unquote, is a verb, like it's something you have to do every day, right, to maintain it. It's not like I'm a good person, done. At the same time, we also need folks to come to the table understanding that their level of racial literacy, wherever it may be, has nothing to do with their character. It has nothing to do with their intelligence or their cognitive ability. It has everything to do with our socialization. And so if we can get past this notion of, oh my gosh, I just realized I made a mistake, or worse yet, you're telling me I made a mistake and I'm not ready to accept that yet, or you're making me question all of the things I've held true for so long, if we can get past like the blame game and actually talk about, here's just the situation from a reality standpoint. Are you with us in changing this? Do you want to be a part of that change? It's not, it may seem fun and like, rah, rah, we're going to get the whole gang together. But the truth is, like, this work is painful. It's emotionally laborious no matter what side of the tracks you sit on. And it doesn't have an end point. That's the other tough part, right? I wish I could say, yep, you do steps 1 through 10, and then you get to check out, go home, and have popcorn. That's not, this is everlasting. It's deciding, am I going to wake up every day deciding I'm going to be an anti-racist? And that doesn't mean you're going to do it perfectly every day. In fact, like, no one does it perfectly every day, right? But being able to measure, here's where I'm starting from, here's my desired future state of a world I want to live in, of a community I want to reside in, of a of an institution I want to work for, or a business I want to run, right? We have to get on the same page with that. But right now, I think we're still debating whether or not we even have a problem. You know, we still have folks with a lot of power who even right as we are speaking are making it intentionally difficult to even get information out to folks, right? Like our current administration is essentially saying, is blocking information, saying you can't use these terms, like critical race theory, like white privilege, calling it un-American. That's really concerning. It's so information absolutely is key because I will say our American institution of education has intentionally failed all of us. It's very much so possible to have a PhD in history and never know about the Tulsa, Oklahoma Black Wall Street. It's very much so possible to have a degree in sociology and never learn about the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, right? So we cannot rely on the systems that got us here to get us out. So we have to create a movement around this, right? So to another extent, when I first would see folks getting on the highway and blocking off traffic, I remember thinking, I agree with the cause, but like, I just don't agree with that. That seems too, like, that's extensive. That seems very like unnecessary and unhelpful. What I've actually learned about movement building now is that those tactics are actually very effective in forcing people to choose what side of an issue they're going to be on. And I think for too long, the American public has been allowed to sit on the fence. We've been allowed to be just anonymous with this work. And now employees, community members, we're calling every institution, every pocket of power to the table and asking them, where do you stand on this? And a lot of these entities are not ready to answer that question. So I hope that more and more entities get ready to answer the question, and I hope their answer is right. I hope they will be on the right side of history, but that's up to them.
I've tuned into parts of your presentation, and one of the exercises you deploy is you ask participants early on, in your mind, if you were asked, what does it take to get ahead in this country? You ask them that early, and then later you layer on information, a lot of which history, policies, you know, what has happened starting back in the 1600s, right, that has influenced, set horrific pattern of racism. And so you ask them that again. What, you know, explain that approach and how do people react to that?
Well, my intent behind asking that question is to help us all interrogate what we have held as truth. And the reason why I ask people to share that is because one, it creates a space where we're for the most part experiencing something similar, right? We're like, yeah, that's exactly what my parents taught me, that as far as what it takes to get ahead, work really hard, get a good job, do what you're supposed to do, right? Whatever that is. And not that I want to, you know, harm anyone's view of their great-great-grandparents, you know, and it doesn't mean that that folks didn't work hard to get where they are, right? It just means that maybe some of our perspectives were formed by incomplete information. Again, to no fault of our own, but we perhaps have developed a very strong opinion around a topic that we actually don't have all the information about. I personally dedicate about 3 to 4 hours a week just to my own education. The average American probably, one, doesn't have time to do that, doesn't have the will, for whatever reason, right? And I'm still learning things as I go on, right? When we do ask that, when we ask it the second time after setting the stage and providing some context, again, that's the context I provide in my workshop. We would need 3 weeks minimum even to cover, you know, one century. But what I find is that for folks who are ready and who are willing, they respond I think, in a way that acknowledges that people experience this world differently based on the color of their skin. And then for others, their response is, well, it takes money to get ahead in America. Like, they can't bring themselves to say, who has had access to money, and who has had access to land, and who has had access to, you know, to wealth building generationally. They can't quite yet bring themselves to that. And I don't pretend to, I'm not going to claim I know why they're at that place. It could be different reasons for each person. I will say, though, I think that we still have a ways to go with people even getting comfortable and de-tabooing having conversations about race. Because if we cannot have conversations about race, how are we ever going to dismantle racism?
There are so many stepping stones that created this inequity. And I think that you said your own father experienced that inequity.
If we keep in mind that the Fair Housing Act was not in place until 1968, this means that my father, in his early 20s, was not able to purchase property wherever he wanted to. He was relegated to specific areas, and this is due to not only redlining, but also to racially restrictive covenants. And I want to mention historian Reggie Jackson, who actually gave me the gift of this information, but it created some conversation with my own father around this issue. What he did to get around this at the time was to have my white mother be the purchaser of certain properties. My parents are in real estate. So I share my own family story, again, for the same reason that facts don't always change behavior. I think data is one thing, but I think most of us humans respond to human stories. And I hope that people will hear my family story, and perhaps it will inspire them to question their family stories and to dig a bit deeper themselves.
Here we are back in 2020, and you've said that people ask you, what can I do now? What will fix this? What can I personally do to, you know, make this all go away or get better? So talk about being an ally versus a co-conspirator.
To be a co-conspirator means you're willing to put something on the line, whether that's financial, power. Right now, we are in a state where the average white American is not even willing to have an uncomfortable dinner conversation, let alone put power and money behind an issue, right? So that's something to think about. When we think of allyship, an ally is someone who, they're doing the work in terms of educating themselves. They recognize that there is there's opportunity to bring folks in and to have them join the table. They're not quite yet ready to relinquish control of that table. They still want to be centered in the work rather than asking continuously, how can I decenter myself as the person holding power in this space? I think that's the other aspect too. If we are not asking ourselves, what positions of power do I hold? I don't care if you are a stay-at-home mom. Simply being able-bodied allows us positions of power, right? So continuously asking, what positions of power do I hold? What circles of influence do I have access to? And how can I maneuver in those spaces that will create equity? So, yeah, what are you willing to put on the line? Are you willing to challenge a policy in your organization that is inequitable? Are you willing to respond to a comment by someone who's in a superior role than you? Are you willing to walk away from a job that is doing things that are hindering racial equity? Again, and that's not for me to answer, but at the very least, like, are you willing to be uncomfortable? And honestly, in honor of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, when she was asked, you know, when something to the effect of when will the Supreme Court be, you know, equitable? And I believe she said when there are 9 women on the bench. And when they scoffed at that, she said, well, what? There's been 9 men on the bench forever, right? So why would this be different? So the same thing to me applies to companies and organizations. If your organization is over, you know, 70, 80% white, to fail to say the next, for every next position we hire, it's going to be a person of color. If you cannot say that, then to me, what you are saying is, I don't believe that there are any qualified people of color to fill these positions. Because why would you not, right? Because if your fear is, we want to make sure the person's qualified, well, that should go without saying. And if you already have an overrepresentation of a particular identity group, why would you not stand behind then saying, we can find an accountant of color, we can find a marketer of color, we can find a land steward of color, and actually, you know, move through that. Ideally, we get to a point where our organizations are doing this work so intrinsically that you are organically attracting a diverse talent pool, right? That you are organically retaining that talent, and that everyone feels that they can thrive, has a voice and equal opportunity regardless of their identities. Ideally, that's the end goal, right, for that. But until then, until then, we have to stack the deck, because the deck is already stacked against people of color. It has been. And I don't say this to have a, oh, woe is us thing. It just is what it is. The numbers don't lie. In every single corner and facet of society, race is the key determining factor of thriving. And not to the advantage of people of color. Right? So to me, I would love to see organizations commit to that and stand behind that. I just don't know if they're ready to do that, if they have the wherewithal to acknowledge that is a step that they would need to take.
What is your gut feeling about the likelihood of long-lasting steps beginning now?
You know, my colleague, Dr. Monique Liston, has said recently that it's not as if enslaved Africans were sitting around thinking, what kind of workshop can we put the slave owners through so that they'll stop oppressing us, right? So I say that because the reality is, never in our history has power been relinquished willingly. I am hoping and praying that this is the time, because I like many of us Americans, I desire for this movement to be peaceful. However, the lived experiences of people of color are not peaceful. There is continuous violence, verbal violence, physical violence, violence against families. Women right now in internment facilities are being robbed of their ability to bear children without their consent. This is the country, the world we're living in. So in terms of just my hypothesis of if we're ready, if this is going to be the turning point, I don't know. But I think this will be the last generation that tolerates it one way or another.
August Ball is the founder of Cream City Conservation Corps and Consulting. She spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz. Coming up next, we'll learn about this year's virtual Doors Open Milwaukee. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Historic Milwaukee's Doors Open event is usually one of the most popular fall activities in the city. It allows people to explore sites and buildings, normally off-limits to the public. But of course, with the coronavirus pandemic, the organization had to adjust. Starting tomorrow, the 10th annual Doors Open will be virtual, offering more than 80 Milwaukee building tours through photos, videos, and 360 virtual reality. This year's event also features a downloadable neighborhood activity book designed by artist C.K. Ledesma, available in both English and Spanish. Grace Feuer is the events director for Doors Open, and she says that despite the new challenges, Historic Milwaukee still wants to offer a robust program. Feuer, along with artist C.K. Ledesma, joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share more.
Like many organizations where the word pivoting is at the forefront of what we're all doing, and Historic Milwaukee hosts all of our events in person. So we offer walking tours and other programming that takes place face-to-face with volunteer docents. So it's been definitely a challenge. We're looking at producing some virtual tours, and we've done a few other virtual programs over the summer, but Doors Open is by far our largest event that takes place every year. And so it's been a really great challenge and interesting to wrap our heads around new ways for people to interact with Milwaukee buildings without going to them physically.
So of course, in the past, the focus is all of the great Milwaukee buildings that are normally not open to the public or some areas that aren't accessible. And this year, the focus is on neighborhoods, which of course helps because people can certainly walk and be outside in a safe manner. So outside of the self-guided tours, can you share with us some of the video tours and what neighborhoods you're highlighting this year?
We were very fortunate to receive a grant from the Zilber Family Foundation to produce two really great in-depth neighborhoods, one focusing on Clark Square and the murals and sculpture and art that is there, another focusing on the Lindsay Heights neighborhood, and that's more of a comprehensive tour that features the parks and residents and organizations and businesses of Lindsay Heights. And then a third tour, which we received support from the Johnson Controls Foundation for, is featuring the Haven Woods neighborhood and, again, businesses that are there. So we're really excited. We've been working with Tank Think Media to produce these videos, and we've really gotten, I feel, to be able to tell neighborhood stories in a way that go beyond buildings. And so we're hoping that we're able to share a more in-depth and comprehensive picture of Milwaukee's neighborhoods through these video tours. We also hope that it's just the tipping point and that people will watch the video tours and then want to and feel invited to go visit these neighborhoods and continue exploring on their own.
Yeah, you mentioned, you know, going beyond buildings is such an important point. And CK, you've created a neighborhood booklet for Doors Open. So can you share how that came together and what you brainstormed on what to include? I imagine it's such a wide span of potential options. How did you tackle this project?
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to start by saying that the activity book idea was not necessarily specific for Doors Open, but I had been working already in a booklet, activity book of Milwaukee, right? I think the pandemic as an artist brought different challenges of how we interact. And as an artist who has community at the forefront, how we interact and how we build community and how we can share together. So I created an activity book called Gathering Place by the Water, where I was asking different artists to collaborate with me and sort of give a gift and a piece of themselves and their craft to this space, the activity book. And then I worked with Woodland Pattern Book Center to host the books on their website, where people can download and interact with these activity books. So it was sort of an pivoting, right? Pivoting the idea of Gathering Place by the Water as experiences and things, but at the same time, still keeping in mind Doors Open. So like Grace mentioned, not only buildings, but also people and experiences and what happens within the neighborhood. So I am kind of using the same model that I use for Gathering Place by the Water and just shifting it a little bit for Doors Open in Historic Milwaukee.
So what did you feel was important to express about Milwaukee's different neighborhoods within this booklet and through many mediums, it seems?
Yeah, exactly. Many mediums. We asked people from actually the neighborhood and the business improvement district to share what they thought their neighborhood should speak about within the booklet, right? As an artist, I'm always conscious. I don't live within these neighborhoods, and I don't want to seem like I'm an outsider coming in to speak on behalf of anybody. I want to be a conduit for people to share their own stories. So it's been an interesting challenge, right? Because some neighborhoods want to focus on this one amazing project they have, and then other neighborhoods want to focus on location. So it's been, as the curator, I guess, of this activity book, it's been interesting to see how diverse and how we can experience different locations in different levels, not just within the built landscape, but also the culinary landscape and also the storytelling landscape of the city.
And of course, your experience in Milwaukee shapes how things come together. So what are your favorite parts about the city that you were excited to include?
There's so many. So I am a transplant from San Juan, Puerto Rico. I've been living in Milwaukee for 13 winters now. I count my years in Milwaukee in winters, not years. And I think what I am most excited to share with the people who will be interacting in the activity book is the Latinx aspect of it, right? As a person that grew up in the Clark Square area, but now lives in River West, I think I have different experiences and different inputs to share about both locations and just bringing my own flavor and design and language. I'm also interested very much in the divide between English and Spanish as a speaker of both languages, right? How we can make this activity book and the space feel more inclusive and inviting people and make people belong within this conversation of, I personally would love for everybody in Milwaukee to interact with it and to share it, but we can't do that if English is the only source, right? I would love to have it in a plethora of languages.
And of course, outside of people's languages, where they live, there's also ages. Say families of all ages are looking for activities that they can still do together safely. What would you guys recommend for that this year?
In addition to the neighborhood activity booklet, which will feature 16 neighborhoods, we're building a web page for each of those neighborhoods that will have recommendations of places to go and things to see, which, as Eric mentioned, we gathered mostly from residents and bid directors of those neighborhoods. And a theme that I'm seeing throughout each neighborhood and what we're seeing largely throughout Milwaukee right now is a lot of art, a lot of public art installations and murals. And so it's been great to see and be able to put those on our website as ways for people to interact with neighborhoods safely as a jumping point. So many of the neighborhoods we recommend places to eat, get takeout, some public art to look at, and really important institutions and businesses to be aware of. And again, as with the video tours, we hope that these are jumping off points so that people can just pick out these little kernels from the neighborhood and then continue adventuring and exploring on their own and really continue learning. And again, Milwaukee is more than just a place with 16 neighborhoods. There's many more neighborhoods than that. Mm-hmm. So we hope that people will go beyond those neighborhoods as well and use this as an opportunity and a template to find ways to be comfortable going into places that they might not be familiar with otherwise. Something that CK and I have been discussing as well is the idea of encouraging participants to create activities based on their own neighborhoods and places where they live. And so we're excited that this year we can hopefully not just encourage people to visit places that they're unfamiliar with, but possibly develop opportunities for people to familiarize themselves with their own neighborhoods and get to know where they're from.
One aspect of Doors Open is, of course, going in lots of grand structures, and you are doing some online building tours, and one of which is the Bradley Symphony Center, which all of us have seen being worked on, but this is kind of the first opportunity to really take a deep dive.
We're very excited to be partnering with them this year. It would have been a really great opportunity to visit the building in person, but we're still excited that we're going to be able to offer some virtual tours with them. So specifically with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, we will be offering a virtual Zoom program that people can register for. It's free and they can learn about the renovation of the building from their president and director. And then they will also have a webpage on doorsopenmilwaukee.org that you can visit to take a 360 tour, a video tour, and check out photos of the renovation there. It's really spectacular and a beautiful building that we can all be proud of. But we do have over 70 virtual tours, and these are all, many of them are places that have taken part in Doors Open before. We do have over a dozen that are new sites that have never participated in Doors Open. And again, we are so grateful to all of these individual sites for pulling together photos and videos and 360 virtual reality tours to show off their buildings to people who wouldn't be able to visit them in person. And this is another silver lining, which is that it is an opportunity for people who might not have great mobility to be able to see all of these spaces from the comfort of their home.
So how has focusing this year virtually challenged the way you've looked at doors open in the past?
Yeah, that's a great question.
It's a really good question. So like, I am not necessarily directly affiliated with Doors Open, but I have created the art for the last three Doors Open. And I can't speak directly to what Doors Open is experiencing, but as a person who lives in an intergenerational household, as a person who lives in a household that is multilingual, as a person who lives in a household or has direct family members who have different capabilities, it's interesting to see just not Doors Open, but every aspect of how we engage completely try to become much more equitable when it comes to, you know, like you said, Grace, if you don't have that mobility restrictions, you can definitely experience it through virtual, right? But then you have that other roadblock of virtual. Do you have access to the Wi-Fi? I right now am teaching my younger brother, who is 11 years old, in Puerto Rico through virtual learning, and sometimes our Wi-Fi is really spotty, or his class right now is at 10% of occupancy because some of the kids do not have Wi-Fi, right? So I think there's a lot of challenges that have risen, not only for Doors Open, but for everybody, right? And this is the time and the place to really carefully think through how we can connect and how we can reach and make an intentional impact on people's lives, not just for touring buildings, but for education, for equity in every space.
Building on what Eric was just saying, in terms of making the event more accessible, which is something that we each year try and at least have the majority of the buildings that are open be handicap accessible, and we do our best to indicate that. But this year with the video tours in neighborhoods, we will have those with closed captions so that those who are hearing impaired can also tune in. The activity booklet will be available in English and Spanish, and we want to do more with that. The first virtual program that we actually did this last spring was with John Gerda reading Gertie the Duck, and then one of our staff, who is an accounting intern from Marquette, read the Gertie the Duck in Spanish. And that's not, we had never done a live bilingual program before. So I do think that these virtual programs give us an opportunity to be more equitable, as Eric mentioned. And so we're looking at ways at doing that better. And we're really appreciating the process of moving forward with this. I will mention too that one of the silver linings in terms of having all this virtual content for the individual buildings is that we're creating a robust directory of downtown buildings and buildings in Milwaukee's neighborhoods, so that we will most likely leave that directory up online year round so people can visit it at any point. So hopefully it would be an educational resource for school aged children. It could be something that tourists from other cities visit in order to plan their itinerary when they visit Milwaukee. And so we are looking at that as one of the advantages to creating all of this virtual content for the long term.
Yeah, I think also I want to add to that, Grace, that an activity booklet, right, it can live in many different spaces, right? I think activities, it can be downloadable as a PDF online. It can live physically. It can be dissected and turned into newspapers or into illustrations, right? So this program and the idea of creating an engagement piece outside of the material landscape really brings different avenues on how to engage and be more equitable with how people interact with Doors Open.
And even though this experience is going to be different and people normally look forward to physically exploring these places, what do you want to encourage people to do or keep in mind for this year?
One of the goals of Doors Open is to invite the public to experience places and neighborhoods that they wouldn't otherwise visit. So we hope that the self-guided recommendations are something that people still use as a tool and jumping point for creating new experiences in different parts of Milwaukee. And with that said, we do also really want to encourage people to be super respectful when they are out exploring and following social distancing guidelines, wearing a mask, and respecting the neighbors who live in those neighborhoods. people live in these places. So we just want to be cognizant of that and make sure that we are being great stewards and neighbors in our city.
Grace Fuhr is the events director for Doors Open, and C.K. Ledesma is the artist who created this year's neighborhood booklet. They spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can participate in Doors Open starting tomorrow through October 11th. We'll take a short break now, then learn some tips and tricks on how to prepare your garden for winter. That's when Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. Continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. This week, the Milwaukee area has been blessed with some amazing weather. Warm days that turn into cool nights, with just a hint of what's to come. And as we celebrate the turning of the seasons, many of us are looking to prepare our lawns and gardens for the cold months ahead. Every month, gardening expert Melinda Myers joins us to share her tips and tricks on how to make the most of your garden. Melinda Myers, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Joy.
So, you know, as we're all enjoying the fall weather, it's been beautiful out this week. I think a lot of us are also thinking about our gardens, our yards, and how we prepare them for what's obviously coming ahead. What should we be doing right now to make sure that our gardens specifically are ready for the cold weather?
You know, that's a great question. One of the things we often forget about in fall, we get here and we're finally thinking, okay, the intense part of the growing season is over, but our plants are busy putting down roots. And so we need to make sure that we're watering properly. You know, it's been fairly dry recently, so a good soaking when the soil's top few inches of soil are crumbly and moist is a good idea. So just watch the weather pattern, check the soil, and then give it a good soaking, because we want to put those plants, keep them in good shape going into winter. That's really the start of winterizing your plants, is making sure they're healthy. If you haven't mulched the soil, put down some shredded bark or wood chips around those trees and shrubs, or maybe those fall leaves that you collect with your mower when you chop them up with the mower and you bag them, use them as mulch on the soil around your perennials, and that will help insulate the roots as the weather cools down. It helps conserve moisture, reduce suppress weeds, and then next spring you're going to start off with your garden mulched, fewer weeds to deal with, and you'll kind of get a jump start on the season ahead. Plus, it helps when we have those torrential rains, that it helps to slow the velocity of water so it doesn't run off of our gardens and into the storm sewers and create problems with our waterways. And that's where Fresh Coast Guardians has some really good pointers on how to keep water where it falls on your landscape so it does some good for you, less work for you, better for your plants.
Now, when you're thinking about using stuff from your garden to mulch with, is there anything that you should be aware of not using? Is there anything that you should make sure you are taking out of that pile?
That's a really good point. Anything that's disease or insect infected. So if you're growing squash and you have squash vine borer, you want to throw those vines away. Most municipalities allow you to bag them and throw small quantities of disease or insect infested or invasive plants in the trash, because some of those diseases and insects overwinter on the plant debris. And so if you use plant material, fall leaves that have no disease problems, leave your perennials that are healthy stand, get rid of those, you know, cut them back to the ground, any that have some leaf spot disease. Leaving our perennials stand not only provides winter interest, which we all really benefit from in the winter, it increases hardiness, so your plants are more likely to survive no matter the kind of crazy winter weather we have. And they also provide homes for many beneficial insects, the good guys, some bees and some butterfly larvae and things like that. And they also provide food for the birds. And so things like coneflowers and rudbeckia, those seeds you'll bring in the birds that you can enjoy the motion and color they add to the landscape. And then I like to do my cleanup as you on one of those nice warm days, late winter, early spring, or as late as I can stand it when I'm really anxious to get in the garden, versus fall when we've got so many things to do that it's one less project now and you get a lot of benefit by waiting.
Now, although we're talking about mostly cleaning up, preparing for the next year, actually, this has to do with preparing as well, but it is planting. You can still do some planting this time of year for a more colorful spring. What should you be putting in the ground right now?
You know, this is a great time to plant trees, shrubs, and perennials. The soil's warm, so as they're putting down roots this fall, it will help speed up establishment. The air is cool, so they're losing less moisture. You often can find deals at the garden centers and nurseries, but you always want to buy a healthy plant because something that's half dead that may be a quarter of the normal price may not be such a value. So looking for healthy plants. You know, you can also push the season if you've got a little space or a container and plant some greens. I need to get busy doing that. You know, a little bit of row cover, floating row cover. It's fabric that lets air, light, and water through but traps the heat. That will push it a bit. And then garlic. You know, garlic is good and shallots are good to plant next month. And so letting that soil cool down a bit more is a good time. And then, of course, spring flowering bulbs. You know, nothing like watching those daffodils, tulips, and crocus peek through the ground in spring to let you know we made it through another winter. And I like bulbs for a couple reasons. You plant them now, and so it's pretty comfortable temperatures usually. And then when they come up in the spring, the weeds haven't really started growing. So it looks beautiful. And I don't have to worry so much about those weeds competing with the beauty of my spring flowering bulbs.
Yeah. Now, some people might still have plants that are doing okay in their garden, that are perhaps even just producing fruit still. I know I have a couple of pumpkin vines that have some fruit that are hanging out on them. Should we be taking those in now? Should we be letting them stay out there? When is it too cold for these plants to continue growing their fruit?
You know, I'm really glad you mentioned it. I had a late start on planting my tomatoes out in the garden. And so every time the temperatures start dipping low, you know, in the 40s, I keep thinking, please, no freezing temperatures. Because I'm going to be eating a lot of green tomatoes. So the same with the pumpkins and your melons. As long as those temperatures are above freezing, those plants can tolerate it. You know, a lot of times we'll get a frost and then we have 2 weeks of beautiful weather. And that's where those bed sheets come in handy. Why I like the floating row covers is as the temperatures drop and we have some danger of frost in the forecast, I can cover them. They just loosely cover the planting with this fabric, anchor the edges with stones or pipes or those landscape, you know, metal wickets, and I can leave it in place until I need to lift it to harvest. And if we get frost, the plants are protected. But if we get some warm weather, I don't have to ventilate. And so it's really easy. And those products are reusable unless they rip and tear. So I usually get a couple of seasons out of mine. I just kind of keep cutting it smaller and smaller if it does rip and tear, and then I can cover small plantings. So as long as we don't have those freezing temperatures, most of our vegetables are going to be fine. In fact, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cabbage can take a light frost and the flavor's even better. I just harvested some broccoli the other day and it was so good with these cooler temperatures, that bitterness disappears. You know, in the summer I was eating my broccoli, but it wasn't as tasty as it was the other day now that we've had some cooler temperatures, and a light frost will even sweeten it up. The other thing you can do that's kind of fun, if you have carrots, you could leave them in the ground for winter, the ones you don't need. The ground gets just a little bit crunchy, throw some straw or evergreen boughs over the top of that area. And then if we have a winter thaw, you know, it always seems like January or February, the temperature warms up, the soil thaws out, lift those up. Those are some of the sweetest tasting carrots you'll ever eat. I've done it a couple times with great success and can't beat that flavor.
Wow. Now, if you have some plants that you may have put in the garden during the summer because you wanted them to get a little bit of fresh air, but they are perhaps a plant that you'd prefer to have inside, how should you go about that? Should you just leave them in the garden if they've seemed to like that, or should you try to uproot them?
Good question. So things that are not reliably hardy. So I'm thinking of our tropical hibiscus, mandevillas, maybe even some house plants that were really struggling and you thought they'll really improve if I put them outside. You can bring them back in. There's always the risk of bringing some insects in along with them. And we'll talk about that for a moment. But now that the temperatures are getting cooler, it's time to start thinking about gradually bringing them inside. You know, when we get these temperatures at night in the 40s, most of those plants should start moving indoors. What I like to do is bring them in, put them in the sunniest window I have, and then gradually, if they belong in a lower light situation, gradually reduce the amount of light those plants receive until they get to their final destination. Artificial lights are a great way to help in that transition or just to eliminate the stress. We'll often have those plants drop leaves because the leaves have adjusted to that bright sunlight outside, even if a shady spot, and now they're in much lower light, so they're blocking some of that light, which is less that they're getting inside, and so we'll often get yellow leaves. The good news is most plants will recover and send out new growth. So gradually introducing them, check for insects. I have pets, so I always like to use organic products, like a Summit year-round spray oil that will suffocate scale all stages, mites and aphids, but it's safe. It's safe for my grandkids. It's safe for my pets. And so, you know, looking for those organic options if you're going to treat. So before you spray a pesticide on your plant, check the label. That's going to give you the information you need and help you make a good decision. And one application is usually not enough. So if you find insects, isolate those if you have other plants that are still inside. And so that's a good way to do it. And the other thing might be cannas and calla lilies and gladiolas, dahlias. Those, after a light frost, we can dig those, put them in a warm, dry location till they kind of, you know, those wounds close up, remove any soil, don't scrub them, just kind of brush off any soil, cut off the dead foliage, and store them in a cool, dark location for the winter. And that's one way we can overwinter those things. So then we can either start them inside next spring or plant them directly in the garden. We'll just get flowers later in the season if we wait until after the danger frost has passed next spring. But those plants can come in after we have our first frost of the season, of the fall.
All right. Well, Melinda Myers, thank you as always for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you.
Melinda Myers is a gardening expert and a regular Lake Effect contributor. For those who are interested in learning even more about preparing your yard for fall, Myers will be hosting a virtual seminar on the topic on October 7th. You can find a link to more information at WUWM.com. We have time now for a song. Although the coronavirus pandemic has meant the Lake Effect team can no longer have in-studio performances, Milwaukee musicians have continued to create music. Our Pandemic Performer series has been highlighting some of this work, including music by Milwaukee-based singer-songwriter Andy. Her song, An Angry Woman, explores a time in her life characterized by her own overwhelming anger, how she dealt with that anger, and how she moved past it. Here it is, Andy performing An Angry Woman.
Tell me, what am I supposed to do when I'm conquered by the thought of you, but you won't reach out. Frustration builds inside my heart, my peace begins to fall apart, and I'm plagued with doubt. I've been trying to find my way back. I've been searching for the peace I trying to put into words the way my thoughts are most like birds that can't be caught. And and as each one escapes my head, they start to pluck apart the threads, and I can't be fought. I've been trying to find my way back, and I've been searching for the peace I lack, 'cause an angry woman, an angry woman is hard to love. Ooh. Darling, I cannot be blamed for animals I cannot tame. Be patient with me as I slowly deconstruct this maze and start to pick apart my ways. Someday I'll be free.
That was An Angry Woman by Milwaukee singer-songwriter Andy. You can find our full conversation with her at WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Audrey Nowakowski and Becca Schimmel join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Jack Urbanis. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Susan Bentz and Taryn Powell from the WUWM News team this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can join us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.